Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 14th of April, 2021, and you're listening to Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index. Joined as usual by Phil Bishop, editor of our online news service at theconstructionindex.co.uk. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm very well, David. I had a beer in a pub beer garden this week, a Monday evening, so that's put a spring in my step. That all is good.
Blimey, that doesn't take much to put a spring in your step, Phil.
busy programme this morning, lots to talk about. And later, all being well, we'll be joined by an old friend of mine to talk about his work at the Prince's Trust. But before that, I'm going to delicately tread into a minefield, which I am very aware that us pink-faced middle-aged men, are utterly unqualified to talk about, but let's have a go, and let's apologise in advance.
Yeah, go for
it. If we upset anyone or say the wrong things, but we will do our best, because I was interested to read the statement from Morgan Sindall, announcement to the Stock Exchange. Morgan Sindall, one of our biggest construction companies, publicly quoted, have appointed a woman called Cathy Quashy to the board as a non-executive director who joins in 1st of June. I was not aware of this woman before, but she's a senior executive from the mobile phone industry. She's a director of Vodafone and has worked for several other of the big phone companies. And while non-executive directors are normally middle-aged / getting on towards elderly or retired white men who are either ex-senior partners of big accountancy firms or city law firms, they are very much of a type. Well, she has herself, on a Vodafone press release I described, talked about BAME, so we can use the word BAME. She's a woman of colour, which is... The journalist in me thought, right, how do I treat it? Is this a big story? Normally, I don't even particularly get excited about non-executive director appointments if they're someone I've never heard of. And non-exec directors are very much sort of, you know, boardroom behind the scenes, not involved in the day-to-day running. And most Morgan Sindall employees probably don't meet the non-executive directors. But this one, I hesitated to think, is this the first black woman on the board of a big construction company? And I thought, well, if I make a point of that, should we even be talking about this? Is it... By making an issue of it something to talk about, is that wrong? Because it shouldn't be an issue. And it's only an issue because we're making it an issue.
Well, I can understand you being feeling sensitive about this, and I perfectly understand that. But I often find that this is... We'll get a press release, for example, from somebody saying, you know, we've appointed two women to, you know, the... board of directors or something like that, and they'll make a big thing of it. The industry itself seems to be perfectly happy to trumpet these achievements, if you can call it that, by appointing either a woman or somebody from a minority racial group or ethnic group, as if it's something that they really deserve to be congratulated on. When in actual fact, we all know that the construction industry doesn't have an image of being particularly diverse, and so women are in a minority, and ethnic groups are in a minority, as they are in lots of other industries, I assume, but construction very particularly. In a way, I think that yes, we should give a nod of approval when somebody makes a conscious effort to try and increase the diversity of their boardroom. I think that's obviously a good thing. It depends how much of a deal you make of it, though. If somebody makes too much noise about having appointed a black or Asian minority ethnic person to their board of directors, does it betray the fact that perhaps they're doing it as a way of virtue signalling?
Well, Kathy Quashie is clearly not ticking your box here. She's clearly a bright, capable, going places woman.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So that's not what we're talking about here. But you're talking about in general terms. And Morgan Sindall didn't even put out a press release particularly. It was just a city statement that they have to do.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think they were making a big deal of it at all. No,
you're right that on the one hand, it's important that diversity has to be visible, and therefore the different kinds of faces and lifestyle types and any other form of diversity that we care to get into, they have to be visible. And yet at the same time, when presenting them as visible, I think we need to not get too excited about their visibility. Just say, yeah, sure, so what, they're there. But anyway, I decided not to make a great song and dance about that. Yeah. And I'm glad I didn't, because the things of homework, she's not the first black woman in the boardroom of a top construction company. Kia has got Dame Heather Rabatz as a director, which I hadn't realised.
No.
Heather Rabatz, older listeners may remember her as the former chief executive of Lambeth Council, where she had quite a high profile and a difficult job. She's perhaps more famous these days, more recently being a director of the Football Association. So she's a high-profile Dame Heather Rabatz, well-known person, and she's on the board at Kia. But I had a look to talk about more generally about diversity of gender and ethnicity on the boards of some of the big contractors. I had a quick look at their websites to see who they were, and on the whole, I think a fairly typical, you know, board. The biggest company we've got is mm-hmm. Balfour Beatty, and their board is pretty typical of what the construction industry looks like. It's 6 white men and 2 women, mm-hmm. and it may not have been. I bet 20 years ago it would probably been 8 men. The industry is moving and quite enthusiastically. All sorts of initiatives, and maybe we can in a minute go on to talk about company wide. But at the moment, I'm just talking about the boardroom. Galliford Try, similar for. Four men, 2 women. Mace, 7 men, 2 women. And this is sort of the typical ratio. I was interested to see Costain. I hadn't realised women outnumber men on the board, on the main group board, including Chief Financial Officer Helen Willis. I thought there'd be more. There's certainly scope for more Chief Financial Officers, CFOs, to be women, given that women are increasingly catching up, I should say. Well, women make up 44% of full-time accountants in the UK, but they skew young. They tend to be, so if you look at 20-something, 30-somethings, you'll get more women accountants than men, and they are on their way to the boardroom, I guess, but not there yet. Women account for less than 25% of partners with the top accountancy firms, for example. But that is clearly going to change. So in the future, we'll see more women CFOs in construction, I'm sure. But Costain, and amongst those 5 women is another woman who demonstrates diversity in the boardroom, who has a Chinese father, Wikipedia tells me, and I've no reason not to believe it, Jacqueline de Rojas. But it, of course, there's different rules apply for the stock market publicly quoted companies than for private companies. But the big private companies try to model best practice, CBI guidelines and all these sort of things. But you look at, for example, you know, Waites and Wilmot Dixon, a couple of family firms. It's both Waites and Wilmot Dixon have only got one woman each in their boardrooms. And Wilmot Dixon, a female director, has been company secretary for 20 years. So she's been there a long time. I don't know if she's been on the board for a long time. She's been a long-serving company stalwart. Waits, of course, their board is skewed by the fact that they've got 5 men called Waits on there. And I think there are Waits next generation young women working their way up, but they're not of an age yet to reach the board. And I spoke to Chief Executive of Waits, David Allen, last month. And I said, you know, you as a company, you say great thing. Don't do them down. They do great things throughout the company. They have significant diversity initiatives, and it's and David Allen. It's clear that it's very important to him to widen the talent pool, and he's very active in all of this. I said, yeah, but it's not really reflected in your boardroom, is it? You know, it's very, very white male. And he says, and I broke down his quote. we are acutely aware that we are not as diverse as we'd like to be. Mm-hmm. And he said, within the next 3 years, we will bring racial diversity to the board. So whether that be male or female, or two birds with one stone, weights is... Okay. Sounds like they're actively... either got their eye on someone who they're bringing on, or they're actively looking for an appropriate person who can bring the level of experience and expertise that they mm-hmm. need. But the Wilmot Dixon one's interesting. Similarly, its board skews heavily male, 7 men, 1 woman. And yet, it scores very highly, if you talk about company-wide diversity. It was the UK's highest-placed construction company in the Financial Times annual list of top European leaders for workplace diversity and inclusion last year. And its HR director, Rick Lee, got an OBE in January just gone, for services to business inequality.
Oh, right, I didn't know that.
You know, Wilmot Dixon is a company, it does this great stuff, as so many companies are. It's unfair to single anyone out for being good or bad, I suppose, yeah. But let's name them anyway. Great for what they do through the company, but they haven't managed to get the boardroom to model that yet. But, you know, it takes time. And I think Langer Rourke is another one we should mention, notable, because, of course, they appointed a female chief executive, which is very unusual, in 2013. Anna Stewart took over from Langer Rourke. And rather tragically, she was only in the job until 2015. Her illness forced her premature retirement and premature death in 2017. So she was a loss, not just, I'm sure, to her family, but to the industry as a major important figurehead who sadly was not around long enough.
Yeah. But there, I mean, I noticed there were two stories, in fact, this week. I mean, the emphasis being on women, not necessarily women of any ethnic minority, but two women appointed to significant positions this week. Hannah Vickers, who was the chief executive of the Association of Consulting Engineers, is now chief of staff at MACE, which I suppose is a step up. And more interesting, I thought, was a woman called Tara Della Hoy, who we've mentioned BBA, the British Board of Agrimond. In fact, we had their chief executive on the podcast recently. They're having a big change of personnel at the top. And Tara Della Hoy has joined as operations director. And she's very interesting because she started off as a train driver. She's been in the rail industry for about 24, 25 years. But she started off driving trains on the Heathrow Express and is clearly a woman of prodigious talents, because she's moved up, became, I think, she was in charge of recruitment, I think, in the London Overground at one point before joining the BBA. So very capable woman there. And I'd never heard of her before, but her career will be interesting to watch.
While the rail industry is not exactly the construction industry, we've said before that what is one of the things that's so great about the construction industry is the scope for climbing the ladder. It is really, if you've got the energy and the aptitude, you can get on. The boardrooms are full of self-made people, male and female.
Yeah, absolutely true.
We should move on to another topic, David.
Yes, indeed. Yes. What takes your fancy, Phil?
Well, I was interested in a consultation paper that the Institution of Civil Engineers have put out. They're asking questions about the National Infrastructure Commission.
Oh, yes.
They're a bit concerned that let's say they think there's scope for improvement. And it's quite interesting because it's one of their own that heads up the National Infrastructure Commission. Sir John Armitt is the chairman of the commission, and he was the president of the Institution of Civil Engineers. And possibly our best known civil engineer at the moment. I don't know.
I would have thought so. He
was president of the Institution of Civil Engineers when the commission was set up. Anyway, the question: if you've seen the news report we've put on the constructionindex.co.uk website, you'll be familiar with this story. They're wanting views from interested people, the ICE, whether the remit of the National Infrastructure Commission might be or should be changed, whether it would be benefits to it. For example, should there be a fiscal remit to the guide? There's not much point in the National Infrastructure Commission saying, we should have a they haven't said this, but if they say we should have a tunnel from Liverpool to New York, if we can't afford to build it, and if there's some sort of financial things, right, we've got 100 billion, how best can we spend it? At least I think that's what the question is.
Because the whole idea of the commission, if I'm correct, is that it was set up as a sort of panel of experts to advise the government, wasn't it? And there was some talk about it taking the politics out of infrastructure decisions. I think that was the thing which caught my attention at the time.
Yes, me too. I was always very sceptical of that. I mean, it's done a lot of good work, the National Infrastructure Commission. It's put a lot of high-profile, highbrow, important, hard-hitting reports out there. So I don't want to diss the organisation for the work that it's done, but it's raison d'etre. It was set up because, as we know, these big infrastructure projects can take decades before we see the light of day. I mean, Crossrail, for example, was knocking around as an idea for, oh, God knows, 20 years, was it, before they actually got round to building it. And these things become political footballs, and it's, you know, someone's priority, and then something gets in the way and something else happens. And the idea was that was the National Infrastructure Commission would take the politics out of it. If we need a whatever it is piece of infrastructure, a bridge over the new bridge over the River Severn or whatever it may be, these experts would stand and say, this needs to be done, and this is the plan. Mm-hmm. And magically, all the politicians would go, oh, okay then. As if if they said we need a nuclear power station in the middle of Birmingham, the mayor of Birmingham is going to go, oh, okay then. Clearly, you cannot depoliticise infrastructure decisions, no matter how independent the body is that's recommending it.
Maybe the role of the NIC then is to provide a sort of a counterbalance. You can absorb the aspirations, the political and social aspirations of your current leader or leaders at the time, and then cross-reference those with what do the experts say, and maybe that provides a balance. I mean,
but it doesn't make anything happen, though. It doesn't really matter what the experts say. At the end of the day, elected politicians, it's their job to make the difficult decision, which will, as like as not, delight. Well, no, as like as not, 75% of people will shrug their shoulders and not really care or be interested, but there will be an equal split between people that really, really want a new bypass or a motorway to be widened or HS2 and people who absolutely hate the idea of it. And some politician or elected official somewhere will lose their job because of whatever decision is taken. And it is inherently political. It's sensitive. And you cannot depoliticise it, regardless of what the experts say.
I think the National Infrastructure Commission is a good idea, and as you say, they've produced some very good reports over what, 5-6 years they've been in existence. We probably never needed an NIC as much as we do now with somebody like Boris Johnson in the driving seat, because I've got a funny feeling about Boris Johnson and his penchant for big gestures,
grand projet.
Yeah, exactly. You need somebody with a level head to say whether or not this is a good idea or whether it's just his ego at work. But how critical is the Institution of Civil Engineers of the NIC at the moment? I mean, are they just seeking advice or comment from their members about what they're up to, what they should be doing?
I actually wouldn't be the least bit surprised if the ICE is doing this on the nod and the wink from the National Infrastructure Commission, that the National Infrastructure Commission actually has its own agenda, possibly John Armitage himself, and I'm merely speculating here, which I probably shouldn't
do. Of course.
But I would, John Armitage has clearly got chums in the ICE. He's part of the establishment there. And if he's given the ICE a nod and wink to say, do you know what, I really think it would be much, you know, my organisation would be able to do a much better job if XYZ, and the ICE is doing a bit of kite flying on his behalf. But one of the interesting things that they, a lot of the questions are really quite, what's the word, arcane, I suppose. But one of the interesting ones is whether the ICE's consultation paper is saying, would it help to improve the process of strategic infrastructure planning if MPs were somehow involved, or if Parliament was somehow involved in the National Infrastructure Commission. In other words, if we stuck the politics back into the National Infrastructure Commission. And I think that makes sense. If the National Infrastructure Commission was combined with, for example, the House of Commons Select Committee on Transport, so the backbench MPs Committee on Transport, and transport's obviously only one aspect of infrastructure, but if that was part, their reports are often quite hard-hitting and powerful. If the two organisations were talking in concert, it would certainly give more. It would give more weight.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, hadn't thought of that. That is, of course, going against the whole idea in the first place, which was to take the politics out.
But you can't take the politics out. Is that, you know?
No, you can't. Yeah. You can't. So what were they thinking?
Anyway, interesting one. Interesting one. Right, I am delighted to say that we're now joined by an old friend of mine, Jonathan Townsend, who's been Chief Executive of the Prince's Trust since December 2019. He has been with the Prince's Trust since 2012, previously North of England Director and Chief Executive of Prince's Trust International. Before that, he had a long career in the drinks and hospitality industry for companies that we all know very well, like Bass and Scottish and Newcastle and such companies. And he's here, I hope, to tell us about the work that the Prince's Trust is doing in the built environment sector. And I should also say, declare an interest, so if I give him a hard time, you know why. John is a very old friend of mine. We shared a house together in 1985-86 when we were at Loughborough University together, back in Granville Street. Those were the days, eh? Anyway... Jonathan, tell us about, please, the Prince's Trust. A bit of background, first of all. I'm vaguely familiar with it, but how big is it? How many people work for it? How much money does it distribute each year? What's its aim and function?
Well, hi, Phil, and great to be talking to you again since those days back in Granville Street. The Prince's Trust was founded by His Royal Highness back in 1976, and it was really intended to support young people from disadvantaged backgrounds, from underserved communities, to give them the chance to be successful in life. And over the last 40 or so years, it's built into a sort of a relatively substantive organisation. And we aim to give young people across the UK the skills and the confidence to move into work, into training and into education. And you asked me about size. In a normal year, in a non-pandemic year, we would work with roughly 70,000 young people a year.
70,000?
70,000, that's right. And we work across Northern Ireland, Wales, Scotland and England. We have a number of centres from which we work. We work with a whole number of brilliant delivery partners. We work in three principal areas. We work in education, so we do a lot of work with schools and colleges. We work in self-employment, and in fact, it was the Enterprise Programme, which is a programme that supports young people to set up a business, which was the programme on which the Trust was founded. And we work in employability, and we do a lot of work in the construction and built environment area. We'll come back to that in a moment. But we work across a whole number of sectors with the ambition of getting young people to into work. And over the 40 or so years, the Trust has helped more than a million young people. Our ambition is to secure a positive outcome for young people, so either to get into work or to get into training or to get into further education. And you asked me about the money, and in non-pandemic year, we would normally work around £65 million, which we don't distribute. We invest that in supporting young people through those programmes, you know, either through our delivery partners or through our own activity to get them into those outcomes. I'm sure you'll ask me, who do we work with? Well, we work with young people who have got many challenges. And, you know, it's a very challenging time for young people at the moment. But we're often working with young people who are leaving care, who've got issues with, such as homelessness or mental health problems, or they may have had trouble with the law. But we do work with a broad spectrum. Young people who are most likely unemployed or have had challenges in their education. And our ambition is to enable them to fulfil their potential, Phil.
What's the threshold? How young is young for the people you help? And do you get applicants and you simply say, well, no, you've got to, you know, you went to Eton and Oxford, get away with you.
Good. I mean, good question in terms of our age range. We work with young people between 11 and 30, and So it's quite a broad range, and it's quite a broad definition of young people. The work between 11 and 16 is in schools, and it's principally in education. It might be in schools or other educational institutions, you know, youth offender institutions or so on. And the ambition in that work, we have a number of education programs. The principal one is Achieve. It's to support young people who are falling behind in their education, both to build their education skills, but also to create a greater awareness of the world of work, of self-employment, but also to strengthen some of their sort of social skills as well, and their community awareness. As we transition into adulthood, and it's a critical transition, you know, we're tending to work with young people still on education, so literacy and numeracy, and STEM skills remain very important, but we're trying to enable them to move in that journey into work. So we do a lot of pre-employability work, and then as young people get older into their 20s, you know, we're focusing on employability and self-employment. We don't have a filter that says if you've been here or there, then we won't work with you. It's unlikely that we would have young people who come to us from those sorts of backgrounds, but we wouldn't. You know, there may be challenges that young people have that you know, related to mental health or other things that might be a consideration for us. But principally, we work with young people from underserved communities, from tough communities, you know, largely in cities, but across the whole of the UK, and it's more likely that you know, they will come from backgrounds that have been more challenging. And what the trust does, you know, when we think about the sort of stereotype of people from the backgrounds you've just spoken about, they have a great network of support. They often have parents who've helped them, parents who can help them into job experience, parents who can help them possibly in their education or into, you know, university or what have you. Many of the young people we work with, they don't have that sort of framework of support. And so the Prince's Trust, along with our partners, helps to create that framework, whether it's through our direct support. We also have a brilliant army of volunteers who support our work at the Trust. They act as mentors. They support young people in all sorts of different ways. So you know, we would never turn anybody away because of their background, but it's more likely that the majority of young people that come to us will come from a challenging background, and we help to give them that sort of framework of support and that journey through, hopefully, through the interventions we make, through our programmes, to a positive outcome of work or education, as I've said.
Jonathan, you mentioned young people coming to you. I just wondered how somebody gets in touch with the Prince's Trust. I mean, is it, can individuals come and knock on your door and say, I need some help? Or do you go out looking for communities, you know, sort of scouting out in communities for people who might be in need of your help and are sort of floundering? Or is it both of those things?
It's actually all of the above, David. We you know, young people come to us from many, many reference points. You know, firstly, self-referral. Self-referral often comes from seeing somebody within their group, a peer, a role model who's been through one of our programs. So we do a lot of peer, I suppose, recruitment, if that's the right word, or referrals. So mm-hmm. self-referral, parental referral, carer referral. We have a lot of formal introductions. So, you know, we do a great amount of work with DWP and job coaches through the job centres.
DWP, Department of Work and Pensions.
That's right. Sorry, Phil. Through those sorts of networks. And we obviously use social media and other forms of marketing to tell young people about the work that we do, to make them aware of the programs that we're running and the changes that we're making. So it is actually, you know, all of the above, and it's a very strong piece of our work that we can use, I suppose, the experience of 40 or so years, the fact that we've achieve the positive outcomes that we have, that we can, you know, commit to young people, that we can hopefully support them into a positive outcome. And I would say to any of your listeners, if one of your children, one of the people you know, a young person who may you may think may sort of want some help from us, please just ask them to look at our website, to Google the Prince's Trust, and we've got a contact centre that young people can call up, and we will talk to them about you know, how we may be able to possibly help. And also, if it is something that we can't do, we will try and refer them to other agencies or other supporters who may be able to help them.
So let's talk about construction and the built environment. Are there any particular success stories that you can tell us about? The people that you've, maybe construction companies that you've helped set up, young people who've set up in the business, or programmes you do with construction companies?
Yeah, so, I mean, we've got a long and extensive experience in the area of construction. And if I talk first about sort of what we do and who we work with, and then perhaps call out a couple of really great case studies of young people that we've worked with who are working in the industry at the moment, who've had a brilliant experience that sort of was started through their work with the Prince's Trust. So in the area that we work in, the employability area that I'm specifically talking about, we run sector specific employability courses, which are run at the moment both in person and online. Pre-pandemic, majority of our work was done in person, but we've used the pandemic actually to strengthen our skill set and mean that we can deliver some programmes online. And what we're intending to do is to give young people, as I've said before, the confidence and skills that they need to be successful. So we run our employability programme is called Get Into. Get Into is a prefix, so it's actually called Get Into Construction, but we might work in other sectors like retail or hospitality. And the course provides young people with sector-specific skills, often with work experience and qualifications. So we would hope that young people would secure their, I'm going to have to translate this, their CSCS card or their construction skills a certification scheme.
We're familiar with that one?
Yes, I'm sure you are. Probably far more than me, Phil, which enables them to move into employment. And we've been doing this for some significant time. We obviously couldn't do as much as we would have wanted to last year, but we're still proud of the fact that we helped 80 young people get into the industry. And broadly, what we're doing is giving them those functional skills. Areas that you will be far more familiar with me, but around a whole number of trades that sit within the construction industry. And when I share the two examples, you'll see how that does differ. But we also support young people in the sort of softer area, the employability skills, writing a CV, how you work, what the world of work is like, and so on. And as I said before, we support that through a lot of voluntary mentors. And we've worked with a good number of companies in the industry, and I'll name some of those in a moment, if that's okay. The second area that we do is we support organisations and collaborating on bids involving the sort of social value requirements, and we've done a number of projects where we've supported. For example, we worked with Balfour Beatty on the East Leeds Orbital Road, where we enabled them to fulfil their social outputs. They supported education in schools in Northeast Leeds. They supported our personal social development programme team, and they also volunteered to support in our centre to do some sort of mentoring and work experience with young people. So that's an element of what we do. And very relevant to now, we're working with the sector on the government's Kickstart scheme, and might perhaps come back to that in a moment, if that's okay, Phil. So who do we work with? I hope you don't mind me name checking
a number
of partners. So Balfour Beatty is one of our key partners, and Balfour Beatty, Vinci as well, Barrett's, Waits, Costain, Mace, Landsec, Arup, John Lang, British Land, NG. And if I just pick on two or three of those and talk to you about the sort of support that we get. So Balfour Beatty have been a big supporter for a long period of time with us, and they've supported us on the employability programme. I actually went to a brilliant celebration of one of their programmes in Newcastle. The CEO was there, which was fantastic. So showed the importance of the programme to their organisation. And also, you know, we heard the young people talk about the opportunity that they had and the opportunity to go into work. And they've supported around 3,500 young people into work through the Trust programme since we started working with them in 2006. They've also been very generous in their sort of financial support for our work. You know, we are a charity. We're funded through donations from the public sector, from philanthropists, but also from the corporate sector. And Balfour Beatty have donated over £1.5 million to the Trust over that period of time. And they also support us through a really enriching way, which is through their staff volunteering and helping our young people, whether that's through mentoring, whether that's through running programs, with, as I said, within our centres. We've worked with a couple of other organisations, just so this doesn't appear to be an advert for one company. So we work with Costain, who've supported us to get over 250 young people into work over 9 years. And they've also supported us, as Balfour Beatty have done, in fundraising and volunteering. And with NG since 2014. And just to give you a sense of the work we've done with them, we've done our Get Into Facilities Management, Get Into Building Services, and Get Into Construction. So there are a number of themes. Obviously, you will know this far better than me. In how we sort of tailor the programs to meet the needs of the employer, so that they get the sort of young people into the jobs that they have, and kind of pulling this all together. Phil, we have a built environment, infrastructure and retail estate leadership group. And that's where senior members of companies like those, many of those that I've spoken about, work with the Trust with an ambition to support young people and principally to get young people into work. And that is a very noble deed, I'm sure you would recognise. But I also think it's very beneficial to them, in that what it helps our partners to do is to recruit young people, potentially from backgrounds and situations that they wouldn't ordinarily recruit from, which this supports them with their diversity and supports them, you know, obviously in that whole area of recruitment. And actually, if I can just do a name check, so James Waits sits and chairs our corporate advisory group, which is the sort of overarching group of employer supporters. So you can see that this whole area has a really important element to the work that we do.
You mentioned social value, and I can see, I mean, now there's a requirement to win public sector contracts that contractors have to, I was going to say tick a box, but have to demonstrate their social value contributions and credentials, that someone like, an organisation like the Prince's Trust would be, you'll be getting more and more interest, I would have thought, from construction companies wanting to get involved so that they are fulfilling their obligations in that regard.
I think we are. I think, you know, I would treat it in a very positive way, Phil, that I think there's, I think it's whether it's a mandatory, well, it is a mandatory requirement, but if we take it in the very positive essence of it, I was involved in a program a while ago, which was actually involved with it. It was a railway project, and I met some of the young people who it was, you know, vaguely around construction, worked on a program around railway, and it was a project in the north of England. And you know, whilst it is a tick box, as you say, it's an incredibly valuable and enriching piece of that work, and I think it's a sensible tick box. I think it's really positive for the young people. They were given jobs that they potentially wouldn't have been able to get, and as I say, I think it was strong for the organisations. And so, yes, that is an opportunity for us, and obviously it has to be right. You know, our principal ambition is that this isn't seen as anything other than being the right thing to do for young people, to get them opportunities that would really benefit them.
Well, construction companies are always telling us about the difficulties that they have with skills shortages and recruitment and retention as well, to a lesser extent, I suppose. The whole industry is getting the next generation on board is one of its biggest challenges that it regularly faces. So I think it's not surprising that there's a lot of support out there for the work that you're doing.
Yeah, and I think, Phil, there's a brilliant opportunity right now. And to talking to your listeners, I think the opportunity to embrace Kickstart, which is clearly a scheme that's of the now, and it's...
Tell us about it. I'm not familiar, very familiar. I've heard of it, but...
So Kickstart was introduced by the Chancellor last September, and it was the government scheme to support young people into work experience. It's of the moment because, you know, with high levels of youth unemployment, and, you know, this pandemic has hit young people harder than any. We've got the proportion of those who've been made unemployed is far higher in the young people age groups, and it's also, you know, more young people on furlough, and young people have been caught up or are caught up in sectors that have been hit hardest. So you've got this real dilemma of, as we move through the the health impact of the pandemic. How do we as a country, so employers, government, organisations like the Prince's Trust, how do we support this sort of build back and young people to move into work? So the Kickstart scheme was introduced by the government. It's an ambition to pull together employers and organisations like the Prince's Trust and to give young people a six-month work experience. It works for employers because the government funds 25 hours of work at, I think, the minimum wage level. It gives young people work experience when they may not have any other opportunity. And through working with ourselves, so what we do as part of that, so the employer gives the work experience, i.e. the technical and the functional piece. And what we do is we support young people through that, what we call the wraparound skills. So, you know, the interview technique, some of the world of work, what's your first week at work like? How do you at the end of the process, how do you prepare yourself for job interviews? How do you build confidence in the work environment? And so Kickstart is a scheme that we have an ambition to work with over 7,000 young people this year on the Kickstart scheme across multiple sectors. Through our leadership group, we have got a very specific team who are looking at placements on Kickstart in the construction industry. And the ambition, Phil, is that young people can, at the end of that, hopefully, as the economy starts to recover, to remove into proper work. And I know, again, just sort of reflecting on your audience, that there's a whole number of organisations, some big, some small, who are likely to be listening into this podcast. And the way that it's set up is that if you're a small employer, there is an opportunity to go through an organisation like the Prince's Trust. We work with Manpower to have, you know, there may be two or three placements in your organisation that you could potentially put on a Kickstart programme. So again, please look at our website and there's more information about Kickstart on there that may be beneficial to some of the people who are listening to this podcast. Mm.
Jonathan, the one person we haven't mentioned in this discussion is Prince Charles, the Prince of Wales, who actually is the prince mentioned in the Prince's Trust. He set up the organisation, didn't he, in 1976. What role does he play at the moment? I mean, does he turn up for events, or is he a figurehead, or how hands-on is he?
Very clearly, David, he is he is the president of the Prince's Trust, and he's obviously, as we all are, at the moment, you know, in thoughts for the Queen and himself and the passing of his father. And obviously we're all very mindful of that.
But generally speaking, I mean, is he in regular contact? Does he play an executive role?
No, he doesn't play an executive role. The Prince is present. He's a great supporter. I think the first thing I would say about the Prince is he is deeply committed to supporting young people and really focused around the work that we do. He's very supportive of our work. He's very aware of all the work that we're doing, but he doesn't play an executive role. He leaves the management of the trust to ourselves, and we clearly keep him regularly updated with the work that we're doing. He's a great supporter, and it's fabulous to have him as president of the organisation. You know, he feels so passionately about the young people and the young people that we help. And interestingly, I was talking about that Govia Thames Link programme at an event last year. I introduced a young person who'd been on that programme to him. And it's brilliant to see how that firstly lit him up, but also lit up that young person and the opportunity of that support.
I mean, I have to confess that until we had this discussion, I knew not very much, let's put it that way, about what you actually do and what you achieve and how you work with young people and also with your industry partners. I'm more familiar with the Prince's Trust when it crops up on the television, usually in the company of a well-known rock band or entertainer. It's a very high-profile organisation, isn't it, from the media point of view?
I think, David, you sort of remembering back to the times when Phil and I were in Granville Street, because there were many of those sort of big concerts back in the 70s, and there was an event a year or so ago. Dana May will somebody will remind me to celebrate His Royal Highness's 70th birthday, and from time to time we do events, and yes, we are lucky to have a great number of high-profile supporters who support the work at the trust. But you know, the reality of it is, and Phil, you asked me a question about how many employees we got. We've got you know, over 1,000 employees who work very hard every day in you know, just about every city in the country to support young people. So I'm not in any way suggesting we don't have a high profile. We very much do, but we do a lot of really, really hard work in the communities, working with some brilliant delivery partners you know, across the countries that support that work. And it's brilliant that we're able to call on those ambassadors from time to time to, I suppose, amplify the work that we do and celebrate the work that we do in the communities in which we work in, because that's simply, you know, just brilliant for us, particularly at a time when, you know, our funding has been incredibly challenged. So it is great to be able to, I suppose, strengthen the message.
Brilliant. Jonathan, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's been enlightening, interesting, and I think a lot of people might be taking a look at the Prince's Trust website to see what they can get out of it and what they can put into it, frankly. It works both ways, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, Phil, I think that ties up a lively discussion today. I think that there are any other topics that we should have discussed and that we've missed out. So I just want to say thank you again to our guest, Jonathan Townsend from the Prince's Trust. And thank you to our listeners. And obviously, we're always glad to get your feedback. Send us your comments, any suggestions, anything you think we might want to discuss at podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. I think that's it for this week, Phil, and yeah, we'll see you again next week.
Excellent. Cheerio.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.